Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's pay attention to what the interest rate policymakers said today, because they didn't actually do anything. They're leaving the Fed's key short-term interest rate unchanged at 2%. Inflation worries are growing, but at the same time, high energy prices are dragging the economy down, which can only lead to one conclusion about where interest rates are headed. Your guess is as good as mine. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by BrandWeek, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives with real-time coverage, now searchable at BrandWeek.com. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, the 25th of June. So the government's interest rate watchdog has stopped taking a bite out of interest rates for the first time in 9 months, and it's barking louder about inflation. Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial.
The Fed thinks the economy's in better shape, and at the same time, they're eyeing inflation expectations, which they feel are rising, and they are very nervous about that.
But the Fed is also concerned about higher energy prices, so a lot of economists think we're going to be in interest rate limbo for the foreseeable future. Today, shareholders in Countrywide, the nation's largest mortgage lender, approved a $3 billion takeover by Bank of America. But before they could take a breath, Countrywide got slapped with lawsuits brought by state's attorneys general from California and Illinois. Both states allege that Countrywide engaged in unfair and misleading business practices. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
To get a sense of just how freely Countrywide gave out loans, consider the case of Peter Sherman. He wasn't sure if he could afford a house worth $500,000. The Countrywide agent told him he could think bigger.
And I said, $1 million. And they said, done. I said, $2 million. They said, no problem. I said, but you know what I make. I've given you all my paperwork. You know I can't pay that back.
Sherman borrowed only what he needed to buy a $300,000 home outside Los Angeles. But other buyers fell for riskier loans. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan wants Countrywide to fix the mess it made.
All of the Countrywide loans that were originated with the use of unfair or deceptive practices, we want those loans to either be modified or to be rescinded.
The Illinois and California lawsuits, plus scores of smaller ones, will become headaches for the new owner, Bank of America. Morningstar equities analyst Jamie Peters estimates that Countrywide already has between $5 and $18 billion in losses hidden on its balance sheet. She says she's split on the merits of the merger.
Bank of America is getting an amazing technology platform. It will become the number one mortgage business in the United States. However, the liabilities associated with Countrywide and the losses building up on its books make it questionable that the company is getting a good deal.
Bank of America has an escape clause in its contract, though so far the financial giant appears committed. The deal is expected to close next month. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There's a lot you can do to pass the time in your car these days other than listen to the radio. Talk on the phone. Glance at your global positioning system to help keep you on track from point A to B. Now, Chrysler is coming up with another option, surf the web. The company plans to unveil a new system tomorrow for its 2009 models, which will connect wirelessly to the Internet. It's hoping the strategy will help increase what have been very disappointing sales. But as Ashley Milne-Tite reports, safety advocates are afraid it'll cause a lot more than computers to crash.
Chrysler's sales are down more than 19% this year. That's worse than General Motors or Ford. George Magliano directs automotive industry research for North America for Global Insight. He says ideally Chrysler would boost sales by making better cars. But in the meantime, he says, introducing some cool technology could give the company an edge.
It might convince a few prospects for buyers to buy a Chrysler product instead of going somewhere else. And I think it's a good idea.
Clarence Ditlow of the Center for Auto Safety says he can't believe his ears.
This is one of the worst ideas I've heard in a long time.
He says internet access on the road will be just one more distraction for drivers, and that'll lead to more deaths and injuries. Rob Richard directs global sales and marketing for Mopar. That's Chrysler's parts and accessories division. He says the technology is meant for passengers, not drivers. He says if drivers want to check email or shop online, they can pull over to do so.
Our mission here is not to have drivers putting themselves or their occupants or any other drivers on the road in any danger. We are strictly looking at this as entertainment for your occupants.
The answer to that is, who is Chrysler kidding?
Again, Clarence Ditlow of the Center for Auto Safety.
The vast majority of driving in this country is done in single passenger vehicles, i.e. there's only the driver. So who else is there to use it but the driver?
He says manufacturers should only allow internet access in cars when the vehicle is parked. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Wall Street spent the day trying to read the Fed's tea leaves. The details when we do the numbers. We're starting to see the effects of tighter lending standards. Mortgage applications are at 6.5-year lows. That's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. Fewer buyers in the market will drive down home values even further. But as commentator David Frum sees it, that harsh reality might not be the worst thing for the country.
These are tough times for American homeowners. Many borrowers are defaulting on their mortgages. Others face a sharp drop in the value of their houses. The larger mortgage market is in crisis. I don't want to speak of this crisis cold-bloodedly, but markets are cold-blooded things, and there's a reason why market watchers often call downturns corrections. At the peak of the housing boom, mortgage debt as a share of household assets had risen to an all-time peak of over 40%. The equity Americans held in their own homes had dropped below 50%, an unprecedented low. These trends are going into reverse. Hard-pressed homeowners are selling their houses and taking their losses. Lenders are taking their losses too, writing off mortgages on an enormous scale. As a result, the United States will soon be a little poorer than it used to be, but also probably much less indebted. Debt, leverage as they call it in business school, is a powerful tool for maximizing profits. It is also a dangerous tool that can maximize losses. When businesses pull back after a shock, they call it deleveraging. What we may be seeing now is a massive deleveraging of the consumer economy. I'll hazard a prediction. In 2009 and 2010, we will see home equity rise again. We will see mortgage debt as a share of household assets decline. And as Americans realize that they can no longer count on their houses and stock portfolios to grow automatically, we may begin to see a rise in savings rates, which had tumbled almost to zero. We've been warned for years that Americans need to save more, borrow less, and work longer into life. The shock of 2008 may at last transform those warnings into welcome changes of behavior. If so, this mortgage crisis may be a blessing in disguise.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org, then click on Contact. Tune into the Olympics on NBC a little over a month from now, and you could be watching a competitive event you didn't count on, the race for the White House. Ad Age reports Barack Obama has been talking to the network about buying ad time during the Summer Games from Beijing. Joining us from Washington, D.C. now is Ad Age reporter Ira Tynowitz. He's been tracking a potentially significant shift in advertising strategies this election year, and today he writes about a youthful new player in the political arena. Ira, who might that be?
MTV is willing now to take advertising. They have never taken advertising for political candidates since they started, and they are now willing to accept it. The expectation is that it's being done so that they can accept advertising from the Obama campaign, which probably will have some money to spend this year.
So this is truly a national campaign as opposed to past campaigns?
Well, it's still to be determined for sure what's going to happen, but yes, that's probably going to be the case. The Bush campaign bought a little bit of cable advertising on specialty channels, especially sports channels, but they didn't spend much on it. This time, Barack Obama may have enough money to spend money on major buys for at least some of the cable networks and maybe some national advertising.
And I take it that it's Obama's decision not to accept these public funds that has really caused this to happen?
That's part of it. The other part of it is there's a lot more states in play this time. As you get more states in play and the economics change and you have the possibility that instead of buying the individual state-by-state stations and broadcasters, what you can do is you can buy nationally cheaper.
When you talk about MTV changing its policy to accept these ads, could that significantly alter the outcome of the election?
It could help in terms of raising the youth vote. The traditional problem in the youth vote has been that youth decide they're for a candidate and then don't show up at the polls. One of the key issues is getting out the vote and getting people to the polls. If you are suddenly able to advertise in a location which they're watching and you can specifically pitch to them, it could be significant.
Any idea what caused MTV to change its position? Was it dollar signs or something else?
Well, I asked them that question and they wouldn't say for sure, except that they thought the youth vote was important this time around and they wanted to be part of it. I suspect that this is not exactly the best time for broadcasters and cable companies in the economy, and that the economy had something to do with it. The possibility of additional dollars may have had something to do with it, but they won't say that.
The fact that Obama can do this because of the way that this funding works, does that give him the edge here?
Well, that's, again, still to be determined. This is the first year that this is going to happen. There is some indication that the GOP is going to raise enough money to help McCain that maybe the National Republican Party can go ahead and come in and do things. The question becomes what you do with the money. If you can significantly affect the turnout, if you can significantly affect the issues, if you can significantly affect swing voters, it's important. If all it does is give you people you already have, then it's not going to be as important. The question becomes, do you reach additional people or do you get people who otherwise wouldn't come out to come out and vote?
Ira Tynowitz is a reporter for Ad Age. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Madonna and Angelina Jolie have turned international adoption into something of a glamour sport. But for most Americans, the process can be grueling. Guatemala has heavily curtailed the number of children it will allow to be adopted. Next week, Vietnam stops taking applications from Americans altogether. That's not just hurting parents. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports it's hitting adoption agencies, too.
Jen Cohen has a bag of clothes in her basement.
A little pink dress with flowers and sparkles and a lot of very cute little dresses and tutus and things like that.
She's saving it all for her daughter. Cohen is single. She's a pediatrician. She lives in San Francisco, and she wants to adopt a child from Vietnam. Last year, she thought she had found the agency that could make that happen.
They had been in business for over 20 years.
But the agency closed down early this year. She scrambled to find a new one, and just as she was filing the necessary papers, another snag. Vietnam changed its adoption policy. Starting in September, Americans won't be able to adopt children from the country anymore. While she waits, Cohen has asked her agency not to show her photos of babies until they become available for her adoption.
Because I know once I see that photo, I'm going to be in love. And then, you know, all logic goes out the window.
Parents aren't the only ones in limbo these days. So are the adoption agencies. Generally, agencies survive on the fees they collect throughout the adoption process. Prospective parents pay between $20,000 and $40,000 per child. But several countries have recently cut off or cut back on the numbers of children that leave their borders. So now, that process is much more drawn out. International adoption advocate Tom DiFilippo says many agencies are barely scraping by.
The number of agencies that will be involved in intercountry adoption will be less than 100 within 18 months.
As many as 600 organizations were in business just a few years ago. Back then, an agency could start the adoption process in a new country without ever having to set foot there.
People were going international because it was profitable.
Herbert Newell runs Lifeline Adoption Services in Birmingham, Alabama.
And I hate to say profitable about adoption, but that's just the truth. People saw that as a profit wing.
Some people also saw it as an opportunity for fraud or corruption. Newell says agencies had to put expensive safeguards into the system to prevent abuses. They also started paying more for the upkeep of orphanages and children's programs. But when a country closes its doors, agencies lose all that they've invested there. It can cost them more than $100,000 to start an adoption program in a new country. So some agencies are joining forces in order to keep costs down. Newell's organization recently banded together with eight others.
Instead of being competitive and going out there and cutting each other's throat out in the marketplace, how can we join forces and work together for the common good of the children?
Together, the agencies expect to handle as many as 400 international cases this year. That makes them one of the largest international providers in the U.S., and they hope one of the more stable organizations around. Jen Cohen is hoping things remain stable as she waits to collect her daughter. 2 weeks ago, her agency surprised her with a photo. She was matched with a healthy baby girl from the Mekong Delta. It'll be at least 4 months before Cohen can go pick up the baby in the picture, and a lot could still go wrong. So for now, she's keeping that bag of clothes in the basement.
If this doesn't happen and you know, if everything closes down and the bureaucracy gets heavy before I get a chance to bring a baby home, it'll just kill me to have all of this stuff in my house.
And if the adoption doesn't work out, she'll also lose everything she's invested in the process, and she'll have to start all over again. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Coming up, rolling the dice on family financial planning.
The goal of the game is to get through the third generation and still have money left. The winner is the person with either the most money or the least losses.
Oh, of course, but first, let's do the numbers. Stocks held steady today after oil fell and the Fed left its key interest rate unchanged. The Dow budged just a fraction, rising 4 points to close at 11,811. The Nasdaq rose 32 points, or 1.3% to 2401. The S&P 500 clawed up 7 points, or about 0.5% to 1321. Stocks got a lift after the price of oil swooned $2 a barrel on a government report that showed an increase in U.S. inventories. Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch were both up more than 1%. J.P. Morgan rose 0.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department releases the first quarter gross domestic product report. The Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime and Drugs holds a hearing on catching fugitives in the 21st century. And it's International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking. The United Nations estimates that about 200 million people use illegal drugs worldwide. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. A relatively small change in the way Medicare does business is set to go into effect next week. But we're not talking small change when it comes to the money that the government and Medicare patients could save. It seems Medicare has been paying as much as double the retail price for some medical equipment. But as of July 1st, suppliers are supposed to start submitting bids. David Leonhardt writes about this today in his business column in the New York Times. David, thanks for joining us here once again.
It's nice to be back.
You start your story today with a basic piece of medical equipment, a walker, and you show a huge gap in what you'd pay at Walmart, for example, and what Medicare pays. Why is there such a difference?
Well, it's because Medicare doesn't buy these things on an open market. Instead, Congress has established this fee schedule that determines how much the government, which is taxpayers, pays for all sorts of pieces of equipment, like walkers or beds or oxygen equipment. As a result, the companies selling this don't have to compete with each other in an open marketplace, and the government ends up overpaying for almost all of this equipment.
So what kind of price disparity are we talking about here?
On Walmart's website, you can buy this kind of walker that I looked into for $60. Medicare has been buying them for $110. Now, the equipment makers will point out that they also deliver it and they will help you set it up, and that's fair enough, so maybe we shouldn't expect Medicare to be paying as little as Walmart sells it for. But Medicare recently conducted a bidding experiment, and that really showed how much these things should be priced.
And how did that work?
Basically, these walkers that are selling for $110 by congressional law instead went for about $80 once they did the bidding. On average, the things that Medicare is buying are overpriced by 26%, which is really quite stunning.
Now, you point out that there's actually some holdup in Congress to get these prices lowered. Why the opposition?
Some of it is that the Democrats who now control Congress are sometimes skeptical of the workings of the free market. Sometimes they're right to be skeptical of the workings of the free market. In this case, I think they're wrong. Some of it is also that the medical equipment industry has launched a very effective public relations campaign. They've increased their contributions to Congress, and they've raised all sorts of little issues, including some scare tactics about how this could potentially deprive people of medical equipment that they need. And what they're really trying to do is prevent competition from coming to this market, and they're trying to protect their outsized profits. And I think if we have a real push for healthcare reform, we're going to see this again and again, in which constituencies that benefit from the waste we now have in our medical system are going to go to Congress and fight to keep their share of that waste. And they're not going to say we're fighting to keep our share of the waste. They're going to claim that they're actually protecting patients.
Yeah, you're suggesting that this is a sneak peek at a battle royale that would ensue if we tried to change the entire healthcare system. Are you suggesting that this is just impossible?
I don't want to suggest that it's impossible. To me, it's really a sign of how hard healthcare reform is going to be. All of us would benefit from a competitive bidding system program in Medicare because we'd pay less in taxes to fund Medicare. But the numbers are so small for each one of us, whereas for these equipment makers that are now benefiting from this closed system, it's a huge part of their business, and so they have such a bigger incentive than we do to fight it.
I guess the bottom line here is if you're interested in this issue, you better write your congressman, huh?
I think that's right.
David Leonhardt is a business columnist for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Maybe you're familiar with the old saying, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. It basically means somebody a few generations back got rich, but the successors in the family had no success in managing that wealth, and they ended up back to square one. Knowing how to talk to the kids about money is a problem even wealthy families face. So the wealth management firm Genspring has come up with a conversation starter of sorts, a board game that's called Shirt Sleeves to Shirt Sleeves. As Marketplace's Sean Cole reports, it's sort of a monopoly game for rich people.
The game isn't commercially available. It's just something that Genspring developed for its client families, who are all worth $25 million or more. Every player starts with $25 million in play money, and from there, the game is kind of a cross between Monopoly and the game Life. You roll the die and move your piece along a snaky row of squares in the shape of a dollar sign.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Some of the squares have instructions on them.
Pay taxes. Roll and pay 1 million times the number.
And every turn, you have to draw a card.
Cash cow. Your son plowed your Ferrari through a field before flipping the car. He's okay, but the car's ruined and the prize Holston the car landed on can't be replaced. You are being sued by Farmer Betty for damages and the mental distress. Holy cow. Lose 3 million.
Everyone starts in Generation 1, and after a few turns...
1, 2, 3. Stop. Wealth transition. Roll again.
You enter Generation 2 and then 3, and there's a separate deck of cards for each.
The goal of the game is to get through the third generation and still have money left. The winner is the person with either the most money or the least losses.
Steve Barimo is Chief Innovation Officer for GenSpring. He had a big hand in creating Shirt Sleeves to Shirt Sleeves. He says the company just wanted its clients to understand how rich families lose everything without actually having to lose everything. The key to staying rich, he says, is good family communication. And the game is supposed to be a sort of conversation lubrication.
So people can get very comfortable, not only aware, but very comfortable with some of the issues that can present themselves. And actually then as a family, talk about whether that could actually happen to them. And so just the sheer communication that goes on within the family is an incredible benefit from families having played this.
But the family who played the game for me did more exasperating than communicating.
Lose $16
million?
Aw, that is sick. I don't even have that much money.
Jamie Bongard lives in a fancy house in Toronto with his wife Karen and their kids, Haley, 18, and Madison, who's 15. They're not GenSpring wealthy. Actually, Jamie wouldn't tell me how much the family is worth, which isn't a shock, as he doesn't tend to share that kind of information with his daughters either. He owns an insurance company, and Karen sells insurance, too.
So sometimes they ask, well, what happens when you die? Do I have to work? Well, yeah, you have to work, but they also want to know how much they would get if we died, right?
Is that true?
Yeah.
My bad.
Anyway, Jamie doesn't think it's time for those conversations yet.
I think my kids are too young still. I think this would be more apropos to somebody whose kids were just getting married or in the family business or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's just something they would appreciate talking about anyway.
He's right. Haley, the 18-year-old, actually said she didn't like talking about this stuff. Moreover, she didn't think the game was very useful.
Because it's not really like you can't help it. It's mostly luck. You roll it, and then you can't be I'd rather do this. You don't really have choice.
Great point, says Steve Barimo. And next year, GenSpring is coming out with an advanced version of Shirt Sleeves to Shirt Sleeves that will let players control the outcome of the game. But I have an even better idea.
Shoot.
Shirt Sleeves to Shirt Sleeves Twister.
I like it. Would you be willing to play?
I'll be there with bells on. I'm going to make $100 with this idea.
Well, maybe we'll collaborate on that.
Contemplating a major career change, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, some Americans who've been looking forward to their stimulus check will get some stimulating news instead from the Treasury Department. So far, it's confiscated 1.8 million rebate checks to pay for things like overdue child support, student loans, or unpaid state taxes. The funds go right to the families of government agencies who've been waiting for that money. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 4 points, basically flat. The Nasdaq bumped up 32 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 jumped 7 points, or 0.5%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Pallone, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Next time, how Bill Gates changed the office culture in Silicon Valley.
The massages and the chefs and the free drinks and the foosball tables, all that stuff. The idea that employees are the most valuable thing in your business, and I believe Microsoft gets a lot of credit for that.
Farewell, Bill. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.